From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Burning down shit ain't gonna help nothing. Don't burn it down shit we need in our community. Take that shit to the suburbs. Burn that shit down.
That was Sherelle Smith, the sister of the man who was killed by Milwaukee police Saturday. She said her family and her brother, Seville Smith, knew the police officer who shot and killed him. The protests and violence that have occurred over the past several days in Milwaukee are not only about the killing of Smith, although that killing sparked the apparent uprising. There are years of inequity, unemployment, and oppression inside the city, as Alderman Khalif Rainey said at a press conference this past weekend.
You know, what I can say is this, is that the city has watched this particular neighborhood throughout the entire summer be a powder keg from incidents in the park, from a murder at the gas station, from a shooting from the gas station owner at children. This entire community has sat back and witnessed how Milwaukee, Wisconsin has become the worst place to live for African Americans in the entire country. Now, this is the warning cry. And where do we go from here?
Looking at the numbers, it's difficult to dispute what Rainey said. According to a report from the National Urban League released this past May, which examined economic data in 70 metropolitan areas, Milwaukee has the largest gap in unemployment between black and white residents in the country and the second largest income gap. In 2015, the official unemployment rate for black residents of Milwaukee was 17.3% compared to 4.3% for white residents. The median household income for black residents of Milwaukee was $25,600 compared to $62,600 for white residents. Milwaukee isn't the only city in the country experiencing such racially based economic disparity. According to the report, there was no metropolitan area in the country where black residents were more likely to be employed than white residents or make more money. Brazil's suspended president Dilma Rousseff has put new elections on the table. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
Brazil's suspended president Dilma Rousseff says she will hold a national vote on early elections if she is restored to power.
I understand the solution for the political and economic crisis we're facing is a popular vote in direct elections. Democracy is the only way to build an agreement for national unity, development, and social justice. It is the only way to overcome the crisis. Because of that, it's important to get agreement on a plebiscite and political reform.
Rousseff made the proposal in a letter to the Federal Senate and the Brazilian people. She said the nationwide plebiscite would ask Brazilians whether they support an early presidential election and political and economic reforms. Rousseff also accused her opponents of plotting to carry out a coup. A week ago, the Brazilian Senate voted to hold an impeachment trial for the country's first female president. Rousseff was suspended from presidency in May over allegations that she manipulated economic figures ahead of her re-election in 2014. Brazil's political crisis has sparked nationwide protests both in support and against Rousseff.
For more on the situation in Brazil and across the Latin American Caribbean region generally, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, welcome back.
Hi, Don. Good to be back talking to you. And as usual, there's so much going on, it's difficult to know where to start. But and I think the most important areas we should look at are what's happening with Mercosur and Brazil and Colombia and Venezuela.
I think that's a good place to start.
So, and in the case of Mercosur, it's becoming clearer and clearer as the weeks go by that the kind of what some commentators are calling progressive, especially commentators, are calling a new triple alliance. Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil, they're referring to a triple alliance from the 19th century colonial era, where these countries backed by British imperialism at that time engaged in a war that virtually set the kind of new, the frontiers for the 20th century and guaranteed the colonial legacy that countries like Bolivia and Chile are currently in dispute over now.
Yeah.
So, but this new triple alliance, Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil, is actually a triple alliance of right-wing governments, again backed by the current imperial power, which in our time is the United States. And they're working in concert to isolate Venezuela and give really very explicit support to the internal opposition in Venezuela to try and force the hand of the Venezuelan government in the non-existent dialogue that the opposition in Venezuela refused to take part in, despite it being promoted by even the neo-colonial entity that the Organization of American States, finally. So in Paraguay, you've got this right-wing government led by Horacio Cartes, who is very much a beneficiary of the, what was it, 2012 coup?
Yeah, the coup.
The soft coup against President Fernando Lugo at the time.
Yeah, the so-called constitutional coup. That was another so-called constitutional coup.
Yeah, just like what's happened in Brazil this year, where we now have a kind of soft coup regime led by this interim president who's usurped power, Temer, who's managed to substitute for Dilma Rousseff. And we can have a look at that as well, what's happening in Brazil perhaps in a minute. And the other right-wing government, of course, is that of Mauricio Macri, who was elected based on a campaign of completely false claims and very, very, very weak policy proposals that was enough to get him a very narrow electoral victory against the candidate of the party of Cristina Fernandez. And Daniel Scioli, who lost that election by something like, I think it was 2%, under 2%, something like that.
It was very close, yeah.
And so you have these three right-wing governments in Mercosur, and now what's happened is that in Mercosur, like so many of these regional organizations around the world, they have a system whereby the presidency of the grouping rotates among the group's members. So this Mercosur economic and commercial bloc rotates its presidency among its five members, Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, who were the founding members, and Venezuela. And I think Bolivia is actually, it's not quite a complete member of Mercosur, and I think its membership has been accepted. But what these three right-wing governments are doing are saying that Venezuela doesn't have the right to the pro tempore presidency, which is it is scheduled to assume, or it should have it actually assumed it last week, and so technically Venezuela is the pro tempore president, but Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil are engaging in a whole series of measures to try and not recognize Venezuela's presidency or its right to the presidency. And one of the things that they're doing is that they're saying that they're not happy that Venezuela has satisfied all the administrative and legislative requirements that it undertook to comply with when it signed up to Mercosur. And I think it actually signed up for that back in 2006. Was when it started its process of joining, becoming a Mercosur member. And it's what Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay are arguing, and these right-wing governments are arguing, is that Venezuela hasn't actually complied with all the requirements, and therefore it's not entitled to hold the pro tempore presidency for Mercosur.
So right.
This is absolutely clearly a move against government of very... obviously against the government of President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela,
but very much in
support of the Venezuelan opposition.
Exactly. Yeah, it's in tandem. It's like they have an inside-outside strategy that they're working against Maduro.
Right. So and that's So you've got that happening on the one hand. On the other hand, you have this very positive development in terms of Venezuela's relationship with Colombia, whereby just this week, just over the weekend, they reopened the frontier border, which they'd closed for three main reasons. They'd closed it in part because of the smuggling that had just got wildly out of control, especially stoked by the opposition in Venezuela and their business allies are ramping up the flight of commercial goods from Venezuela into Colombia, where they can be sold at a higher price. Right. And in particular, that's true of diesel and gasoline and other oil products. Yeah. And the other reason that they closed the frontier, it was the Venezuelan decision to close the frontier, was that they were extremely concerned about a dramatic increase in activity of criminal gangs, most of whom are based in Colombia and have their origins in the Colombian paramilitaries.
Right. Yeah, you've got those paramilitary squads, essentially death squads, that have been wreaking havoc inside Colombia, and they were starting to play in Venezuela as well. And certainly with the encouragement of the folks in the National Assembly, the right-wing legislature.
Yeah, it's difficult to know it's difficult to define what the relationship is between most of the legislators and what's actually happening on the ground in terms of smuggling, right, contraband, petrol, gasoline smuggling, diesel smuggling, and organized crime. But there's definitely some kind of link with certain elements in the Venezuelan opposition, not by no means all, but right. And there are few people in the Venezuelan opposition who are very up to their necks in organized crime and relationships with the Colombian paramilitaries,
right.
And we've seen that in cases that have cropped up over the last couple of years, assassinations of politicians and people active in the Bolivarian movement, right, in Venezuela.
That's right.
And that's very much in tune with the policy of Álvaro Uribe in Colombia, who's he's the political face of the paramilitaries in Colombia. And I think I don't think it's at all controversial to say that.
No, I think even the president of Colombia would say that. So,
right. So
just one on this point. You know, the legislature in Venezuela, could easily show how it felt about the smuggling by joining with and even encouraging further the president Maduro to deal with aggressively the producers and particularly distributors' strike that essentially ends up routing all of these goods into the smuggling circuit in the first place. So, you know, if they really wanted to stop it, they could say, okay, let's stop it in a way that actually leaves these goods in the country affordable to people like they should be. But in fact, they haven't done any of that and have obstructed where Maduro has tried to deal with it.
Well, in fact, there are huge segments of the Venezuelan opposition in the legislature that actively support that, although they may not be directly involved in it. They support that because they don't have a political program. Their program is Maduro out. And that is the beginning and end of their political program.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so they have nothing to offer the people of Venezuela in terms of policy. For example, in the among progressive people, and for a long time, there have been arguments put forward, for example, by progressive writers, and even liberal, right, from on the spectrum, liberal writers like Mark Weisbrot, for example, to more progressive writers like Joe Emmersberger, for example. And they've been writing for a long time about the importance of making the kinds of adjustments necessary for the exchange rate, for in internal mechanisms of internal trade to align prices with what are their current real market values, while at the same time protecting ordinary Venezuelans by different kinds of mechanisms to protect their ability to function as consumers, to enable them to buy things,
right,
despite the proposed rise in prices, because everything's so out of sync in Venezuela But that argument, you'd think that argument would be being made by the opposition. Nope. But it's not actually being made in concrete, detailed terms by the opposition.
No, instead the markets are manipulated by, you know, by essentially the interests that they represent, to the extent that it's not the interest they hold themselves.
Absolutely, and
the result is that as they manipulate the market, it's essentially looted by these people in one fashion or another.
And we can expect nothing by way of serious policy proposals from the opposition and the Venezuelan legislature, which they control with a big majority. And that's, you know, what an indictment. What an indictment of their political motivations, you know. As you pointed out, they could very easily act in a way that would not necessarily be especially supportive of the government, but would certainly be in the interests of the Venezuelan people.
Right.
And they don't.
Right. So they could even own that policy and be the saviors of the Venezuelan people. But it's actually, I take slight disagreement with what you said, to the extent that, in fact, this looting is their policy. That's the policy they represent.
Well, as an outsider, I find it difficult to kind of make categorical judgments about how closely the interests that the criminal interests involved in what essentially criminal economic activity are aligned with the political representatives elected to the legislature. And you may well be right. I don't know.
Well, it's just a deduction that I'm making, because if you look at the objective economic conditions, the program that they espouse of you know, a return to neoliberal capitalism leads exactly here. And so, you know, that's the policy that they're offering while they're taking these steps that enable this looting to take place, which is really and materially the only program they can offer as an alternative to the one that the government is proposing, which is not to let the economy be looted and to try to apply it to the needs of the people. That's the fundamental problem they got.
Yeah, and this whole discussion about, you know, how can the Venezuelan government shift its economic policy into a way that kind of actually acknowledges the current market values, and because, you know, it's actually impossible for them to work in an isolated way in the current global economy, and especially in the regional economy. And it just seems to me that at some point the arguments of people like Weisbrot and Emmersberger are going to have to be seriously addressed, because otherwise the economic policy of the Venezuelan government is heading for a dead end, yep. which runs a very high risk of an outright political defeat in the next elections. But it's a discussion that they're very deeply involved in at the moment. And it's just, from here in Nicaragua, I just find it fascinating to see the contrast with the way the Nicaraguan opposition here, they managed to kind of pull themselves up by their bootstraps, as it were, from having just under 6% support to having just around 10% support in the opinion polls. But when people are asked about who will you vote for in the upcoming election in November this year, and currently the numbers for the opposition are around 10%, and that will probably translate into 25 to 30% on actual election day, because there are so many don't-knows and independents. But the contrast with the opposition in Venezuela is really sharp. And that has to do with the fact that the business classes here in Nicaragua actually support the government policy here. And, you know, you can get into long arguments about the rights and wrongs of that, but it's just a political fact that here the business classes recognize that they've done well out of the socialist policies that have built up a consumer base here in Nicaragua that they didn't have before, and the diversification of trade relationships that has opened up export markets that they didn't have before.
Right.
So the business classes are very much on board in terms of they don't want to see an opposition in power that's going to mess up the good thing that they've developed over the last 5, 6, 7 years under the presidency of Daniel Ortega. Now, if you contrast that with Venezuela, and that's, you know, and it's the exact opposite. What you've got in Venezuela is what you had in Nicaragua in the 1980s. The business classes and the economic elites have taken their money out of Venezuela, and their activity within Venezuela is an economic war against the government,
right,
which is devastating for the lives of ordinary Venezuelans.
And the swing vote on this is the domestic bourgeoisie, basically, which, you know, obviously historically is at a different level of development in Venezuela than in Nicaragua due to historic factors, the size, relative size of the two economies, the oil and, you know, the cash flow that Venezuela had for a good long time. Probably the local bourgeoisie there was able to do a lot better than the local bourgeoisie even under Somoza in Nicaragua, because
right,
just how much money was passing through it. So that may explain their willingness to loot what's left for the next year and a half rather than to settle into a business arrangement.
Yeah, and in Venezuela, they are blessed and cursed by being the country with the biggest oil reserves in the world,
mm-hmm,
you know, and even bigger than Saudi Arabia when you take into account all the reserves in the Orinoco fields. So, what they in a sense, that's a blessing because they have these enormous natural resources, but it's a curse because, in economic terms, their economy has been an oil rent economy for decades.
That's right. Well, they've done better than, say, Iraq, Libya, and other places with oil reserves, because at least the treatment they got from the West thus far left most of the buildings standing and many of the people living.
Right. So yeah. So anyway, that's something that's important to bear in mind when it's, because one of the huge problems for Venezuela is that they had the chance over the last 10 to 15 years to kind of explore ways of diversifying their economy, and they were unable for various reasons to do that in a way that might kind of cut off or outflank the attack by the opposition, which is taking advantage of historically low oil prices. So anyway, that's what's going on with in Venezuela in terms of the region and their relationship with the Mercosur countries, and their relationship with their neighbor Colombia. Shifting to Colombia, the peace process seems to be advancing, certainly between the government and the FARC EP guerrilla. There's still a question mark over whether the other main guerrilla force, the ELN, Ejército Liberal, Ejército de Liberación Nacional, will come on board and engage in some kind of peace process with the government. But certainly the peace process with the FARC, which is by far the biggest guerrilla organization in Colombia, is advancing really well, and it looks as though there's going to be a plebiscite sometime later this year. Still haven't got a date. But one of the disturbing things that came out in the news over the last week or so is that, and there's a group, I'm not sure if it's a UN group or what kind of group, it's some kind of non-governmental group, maybe associated with the UN, I don't know, I have to check that, but they've come up with a report pointing out that, and I think it is actually the UN, part of the UN observer group that's being put together, and to facilitate this peace process that's going to get underway in Colombia once the plebiscite has actually validated the agreement reached between the Colombian government of President Juan Manuel Santos and the FARC guerrilla and their leadership. And what this report points out is that in Colombia there are something like 1,100, maybe a few more, municipalities, and of those municipalities there are a total of around 243, something like that, which are at risk in terms of being able to guarantee a free and fair vote in the plebiscite. And of course, one of the key players in that is Alvaro Uribe and his gangster mate.
Of course. The ones that bring the guns to the polls, basically.
Yeah, and he's saying that there should be that the plebiscite should vote no. So he's trying to mobilize a strong no vote.
Right.
And what that means is that in something like a quarter, around a quarter of the municipalities where the voting in the plebiscite will take place, there's a serious risk of some kind of disruption of the vote for one reason or another.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how the Colombian government proposes to keep the paramilitaries and the gangsters, the organized crime people associated with Alvaro Uribe, from disrupting the vote in those 240 plus municipalities. The other important thing that happened in Colombia recently was that I've forgotten what the body is. It's kind of the Council of State, but I'm not sure exactly. I think that's a government body, or it may be a kind of a joint body between the government and the legislature. I don't know. It's called the Council of State, and what they've done is they've said that the former senator Piedad Córdoba, who was absolutely key in making this whole peace process possible, and for years she and people like her have been struggling to bring this peace process about, first to make it happen and then to try and make it a success once the talks got started. And she's really been triumphantly vindicated. And I think this, a couple of years ago, she was accused by the Attorney General, the public prosecutor in Colombia, of some kind of administrative misdemeanor, some technical misdemeanor, which is a complete put-up job, complete frame-up. They were just looking for a pretext to get her off the political scene. That punishment has been overturned, and she is now eligible to stand for the Senate again. So that's, you know, and that's another important development. And let's hope that it's an indication that Colombia is finally beginning to return to some kind of, you know, some kind of normal political life that isn't dictated by gangsters like Alvaro Uribe.
Yeah, it seems that maybe there's at least some judicial buy-in to the idea of a peace process with a move like that.
Oh yeah, and I think it's very clear that perhaps the dominant section of the Colombian bourgeoisie, the Colombian economic elite, are looking at the global scene now and realizing that they can't, if they don't do something to end this decades old civil war, they're actually affecting their own ability to make a profit.
Yeah.
And I think one has to just keep coming back and focusing on this. I mean, what drives the political actions that come about as a result of decisions taken at a very high level in the region's right wing elites? What drives that is their ability to turn a profit.
Yep, that's right. And we got to stop there, I guess. Maybe we can pick it up next week. We'll take a look at Haiti and some of the other things going on in the region and update on the things we were just talking about, because that's fast-breaking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I look forward to that, Don.
So do I. Thanks a lot, Tony. Catch you next week.
Okay. Take care now.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.